I saw that my body was ready, control. There is nothing free that you can do. No choice for you. You have to request, to beg.
You know, you will see people whom you have more education than them, but they are in higher place because they are in their country. But us, we don't have any choice. We cannot do anything.
In fact, it is very sad. Being a refugee is a sad moment, and it is not something that is good at all, unless the situation demands that you have to run for your life.
Hi, I'm Kim Chakanetsa, and this is The Comb, a BBC World Service original podcast. Each week, I comb the African continent for stories that matter, stories lying just below the surface. You can follow on social media. We are hashtag The Comb, or join our community of combers online. You can find us by searching for BBC The Comb on Facebook. When you think of a refugee camp, you usually have an image in mind. Makeshift tents, the tired faces of new arrivals, long queues for food and water. And these camps are designed to be temporary. But in reality, refugee camps often last long after the news cycle has moved on from whatever crisis has created it. But the Dadaab refugee camp takes this to the extreme. It started as a temporary shelter in 1991, but since then it has seen wave upon wave of new arrivals from Somalia, Ethiopia, Uganda, South Sudan, and the DRC. It's now home to just under 300,000 refugees, and it's sometimes referred to as Kenya's third biggest city. And many of those who come to Dadaab never leave. And there are also those who are born in the camp who've never known a world beyond Dadaab. So what's it like to be a refugee? To have a camp like Dadaab represent your whole world?
This is The Comb.
Ye ni The Comb.
The Comb, no.
Ni The Comb.
The Comb.
I'm Mark Kelo Foyat, a refugee in Kenya from Uganda.
Mark fled Uganda as a young man in 1987. Ever since, he's been living in different refugee camps in Kenya. And where in Uganda are you from?
I'm from the northern part of Uganda, specifically from the Acholi community.
Mark comes from a big family with 9 children, where everyone ate together from the same dish. It's been a long time since he was last in Uganda, but listening to him speak about his childhood sounds truly blissful.
My village itself is next to a river that joins the Nile, and therefore growing next to the river means that I would spend most of my time swimming, fishing. And that is already an amazing period of time. This is how we used to grow. And on top of that, there are some who come with the fishing hook and enjoy the fish. Whatever they catch, they would roast and then eat there and then. So you could see such a situation.
Some of Mark's fondest childhood memories are from the times he spent at the tea plantation his father worked at.
My father was agricultural manager, that means a farm manager, and most of my time when I would see him growing, doing activities in the tea plantation. So I'm very close to tea. That is what I like even so much. I like tea more than coffee.
And how do you take your tea? How do you drink your tea?
I like strong tea, even if the family prepares tea in the African way, because we don't prepare like the British way, but the African tea is when the water has boiled, you pour the tea leaves, boils with the water, and then you sieve. So for me, because of that addict and so on, even if they have done their part, I would still feel to get the tea leaves and pour in my cup.
Growing up, Mark's parents instilled in him the confidence to think freely. So from a young age, he was determined to forge his own path.
I would describe my childhood as a child who has grown in a liberal family and was given all the opportunity to decide for himself what is good, what is bad. I thought I would like to be somebody who is a pharmacist. And during that time, you know, HIV and AIDS had just cropped up. So that was my ambition, that one day if I become a pharmacist, I would really make sure that I destroy this disease.
On top of being a farmer, Mark's father was also an outspoken politician who didn't shy away from standing up for what he thought was right.
My father was 100% politically active. He was a very controversial, I would say a radical politician, who when he sees something unique and strange, he would not agree with it and would look for the right thing that he felt was good for his community, whether it would succeed or not succeed. Practically, I didn't like politics. My ambition was to study up to the sky and do my things differently.
But Mark's plans to be his own man and do things differently got derailed once he returned to his village after finishing high school. It was 1986, and it was a time of great turmoil for Uganda. The then president, General Tito Okello, was overthrown by President Yoweri Museveni. At the time, revenge killings and looting of livestock had spread across the north.
When I went back to my village, and then I would see the kind of issues that were happening. Of course, I didn't get involved directly, but to sympathize with the situation, because the problems that were coming to my own community, people were going to die, maybe possibly even me, I was a part of those people who would be killed.
And after seeing the attacks against this community, Mark decided to join a resistance movement.
So there's this movement that I happened to have joined, which I think was a unique one. That is the Holy Spirit movement of Alice Lakwena. But I joined as a civilian because being a civilian means there is no time that I will ever hold a gun, but I joined as the frontline coordinator of that movement, of the Holy Spirit movement.
Mark's responsibilities involved looking after the injured rebels and ensuring the flow of the logistics, such as food, medicine and money. By the end of 1986, life had become increasingly difficult for the rebels as the government regularly launched attacks against them.
We were in at the eastern part of Uganda, and war was everywhere. The rebels, like us, we were rebels, we were being hunted in every village, and therefore it was very difficult to live there, and eventually that forced me to cross into Kenya.
How difficult was that decision for you, Mark, to leave the only place you've ever known to go to another country and start life over? How difficult was that decision to go?
If you want to leave, you always look at the option that gives you to leave at least for 1 minute or even 1 day or even some seconds, because that is how life is, how living life matters. Therefore, the only way to live my life was to cross the border of Uganda and come into Kenya.
After nights of walking on foot and days of hiding with nothing to eat, Mark crossed the border into Kenya. But he told me that the relief he felt was short-lived, because once he was in Kenya, he was immediately put in jail for entering the country without identification documents.
Oh, being in jail is like being in hell, you know. Everything is controlled. The time you stay in the sunshine is also controlled. Your eating time is also controlled. Your sleeping time is controlled. Everything is controlled. Even the water you drink is controlled, where everything is not enough.
Mark spent 6 months in jail before he was recognized as a refugee. What he didn't know at the time was that this would not be the last time he would be unable to move freely. Now, Mark, you were finally recognized as a refugee. I mean, how did your life change?
Okay, I wouldn't say my life changed because of the politicization of being a Ugandan refugee in Kenya during that time, and somebody who ran from the bush. Nothing really changed because I was contained and controlled in the reception center.
The reception center Mark is referring to is where he had to stay while he was screened by the Ministry of Home Affairs to determine whether he could receive refugee status.
Which was meant to be for people who would stay for a short time and then get out. I did all the documentation to ensure that I would leave the camp and stay in Nairobi and continue with my life. But eventually things did not improve. The government would not allow me to move out of the reception center.
Mark's refugee status brought him some comfort, freedom from prison at least. But he soon came to understand how limiting the consequences of his new identity were.
What it meant to me to be a refugee at that time, I saw that my body was ready, controlled. There is nothing free, no choice for you. You have to request, to beg. In fact, it is very sad. Being a refugee is a sad moment, and it is not something that is good at all, unless the situation demands that things are so bad for you and you have to run for your life.
And Mark's experience was about to change. It was the early 90s, and with so many people fleeing the civil war in Somalia and arriving as refugees over the border into Kenya, a bigger space was needed to accommodate them all. So the Dadaab complex was built as a solution.
They're arriving here exhausted, hungry, and often in need of medical help. Save the Children says 1,300 people are turning up every day from Somalia, more than half of them children.
Dadaab, when I saw it, was a horrible space, the geopolitical space of this area. And Moi's time, it was in the northern frontier district. It was excluded from other parts of Kenya. And therefore, moving from the neighboring community, that is the Akamba community, coming to Tana River and then Northeastern, you have to be escorted by soldiers to a space where you would imagine that you were not going to live even for a minute. And we were shown a space that this is your area, just a space. No house, no structure. This is now your area.
And over time, more dangers became apparent in the camp. The conflict that people were fleeing also seeped in through the border.
Somali refugees were moved to Dadaab. And these Somalis who were moved to Dadaab, they all converged to one place. The communities from different warring factions came to the camp. And then what would happen was that in case of anything that happened in Somalia, it would be imported to the camp. And somebody would be killed in the camp because their relatives killed another person in Somalia.
Weeks turned into months, and the months into years. As the camp grew and changed, Mark changed too. Once he found his place within his new community, the aspirations he had in Uganda resurfaced.
Initially, I was working as an incentive teacher. I remember the first place, you know, I worked under care as a teacher, both in primary and secondary. And then later on, I left, and the problem comes that you are only paid as an incentive.
Because refugees do not have the right to work in Kenya, refugee teachers are hired as what are called incentive workers and paid much less money than what local teachers earn for the same job. That pay inequality is something Mark finds disheartening.
Therefore, I thought of I wouldn't like to teach like any other national teacher and then be paid just an incentive that is less than 100 British pound, you know, but you do quite a lot of work.
As the camp expanded, so too did the opportunities within it. It was during this time that Mark was able to fulfill his dream of studying further. In 2015, he graduated with a Bachelor of Arts, majoring in geography. You have been a refugee for how many years now?
Oh, you can calculate 87 minus, you can subtract this one, 20. It is like 35 years. Yeah, you can imagine.
So what is your relationship now, Mark, to Uganda, to your country of birth?
I'm a Ugandan. That is by citizenship. That is the relationship. And apart from that, what else can I say? I don't have a connection. My life will be in danger if I return to Uganda. Based on the fact, you know, you look at who are those Ugandans who ever went out to back home, and a lot of people have lost their lives and under mysterious conditions, and therefore this gives is a scaring thought when you see people like that. They died, and that makes it very problematic to return.
And so much has changed in his life since then.
My life has changed because even my vision, my thinking and my global perception has changed. I'm now making even a small family here. I have children. I have a wife. I have children.
And can you tell me a little bit about your wife, Mark?
Okay, we just met in the camp here. You meet in the camp, you start courting somebody, and until the person agrees to stay with you, then you stay.
How many children do you have now?
Only 6. You know, in our country, our culture, we don't count children. We only count animals like goats, sheep, cows. Those are numbers you count. But when you come to children, you don't count because it is not proper to count human beings.
While Mark has come to understand the limitations of life as a refugee, when it comes to his children, he's still determined to give them the best of what the camp has to offer.
The best I can do is to make sure that I educate them to stand on their own and look at the world from the perspective of educated people who can maneuver their way, explore and move through what? Education.
When Mark came to Dadaab, he was a young man in his 20s, but many of his neighbors were brought to the camp as young children.
My name is Anab Gedi Mohammed. I'm from Somalia, especially Mogadishu.
Anab's family fled Mogadishu when she was only 2 in 1992.
What I remember was, we ran from everything, our properties, we came here in the camp, we were naked with nothing. It was tribal issue in our country.
If you listen to our Mogadishu's daughter episode, you'll understand what was happening in Somalia at the time when Anab's parents had to flee.
My father was well known in the community. They were trying even to kill him. But thanks to God, he ran away, but there were some injuries in his body while we were coming here in the camp.
Just like Mark, Anab's earliest memories of Dadaab depict the camp as an unforgiving place.
I know I was very young, but the life in the camp was very difficult. There is no even good shelter. The weather is very hard. It's very hot. We were new to the environment. A lot of diseases, diarrhea, whatsoever came there.
And did you understand at the time what it meant to be a refugee?
Really, I understand what it meant to be a refugee. Because a refugee means, somebody who is not living in his country, and you can't do anything for himself. Because, you will see people whom you have more education than them, but they are in higher place because they are in their country. And, sometimes even we face harassment because of their status.
It's very difficult to imagine how hard it must have been for Anab's parents. They were a doctor and a teacher in Somalia. Busy people with full schedules and daily routines, to have to leave it all behind and start with nothing in another country.
We adapted to that life because we have nothing else to do. My father said that, you can see we are in this life and I cannot waste the chance of my children. Let me take them to school.
Anab still recalls how challenging life was in the camp as a student. She'd walk several kilometers every day to attend classes on an empty stomach. But school was where Anab found supportive friends.
When people run from the country, some come with their things, their money and everything. And some came well, they were having nothing. So we were having friends in school, some of them even, sometimes will support you, buy for you the uniform, have stories, tell you that, let us forget the past, we start a fresh life here.
School was also where Anab met her husband years later.
We were in the same school and I was very young and the life in the camp was very difficult. Sometimes
Anab says she felt too young to get married at 16, an age when other teenagers are just starting to discover who they are. But for her, marrying her husband was an important pragmatic step to help her survive the harsh conditions of the camp.
Their families were having, better life from the life I was living. Then he used to support me with the uniform, with the breakfast, with whatsoever. Then he said that if you want I to support you, I will marry you. Then I said, fine. Then that, I didn't even get in love with this man, but it was the circumstances and the hard life in the camp that made me to accept his marriage while I was 16 years old.
At 34 now, Anab is raising a big family.
I have 8 biological children and 1 I'm fostering.
She dreams of giving her children the kind of childhood she could have had in Mogadishu were it not for the civil war that disrupted their lives. But watching them grow in the same camp as she grew up is very difficult for her.
I'm not very happy. My children to grow in a refugee status, but still I don't have any choice. I could only support them that they get educated. God knows what will the plans of the future. So I will make sure that they don't pass the challenges I've passed, and then I will struggle for them and work for them.
Do your children understand then that they are refugees? I mean, do you speak about that with them?
Yes, of course. I share with them everything because, sometimes the security and there were a lot of problems which normally happens in the camp. Then the way they deal with a local person and the way they deal with the refugee, there's a great difference. Refugees face a lot of harassments. I used to tell them, Mommy, you are refugees. You don't have rights here. You don't have country here. We have been hosted. So just don't do any mistake.
The Dadaab has changed so much over the years. There are more schools, there are markets, healthcare centres, soccer leagues. However, some of the main challenges still remain.
The Dadaab is, a closed area. I can say a prison.
A prison?
Because you can imagine you cannot go outside the camp because there is restricted movement.
To move between the different areas within the Dadaab, refugees have to obtain a permission card or they risk being arrested or detained. But if growing up in a refugee camp taught Anab anything, it's resilience and how to see the best in every situation.
The best part of the Dadaab is, thanks to God, I got educated. I'm an important person in the community. I work for the community. I'm also a youth chair lady in the camp. I advocate for youth in the camp. So now the important part is I got education from the Dadaab. You know, whatever you get, the little you get, you are supposed to say thanks.
It has been over 3 decades since Anab and Mark made Dadaab their home. While they've endured the difficult environment and the restricted movement that comes with living in the camp, another obstacle has arisen.
It is very precarious, you know, when you wake up and you hear the announcement that the camp must close, or the camp has been closed. All those things give you a precarious life in the camp where you see that your life is very uncertain. Because safety, security, give somebody plan for the future.
That's the time the government said that we will close the camp. That thing has started, created a lot of tension, a lot of stress, and a lot of anxieties in the camp. Like, I feel worried when I was being told that the government of Kenya will close the camp. So that thinking, and what can you do? How will your life be? You are learning for all these years. There's nothing to do in Somalia. Then some people even become stressed like me. It was, a black day for me when they said that you should go back to your country. And mothers will become worried. We have nothing to do because this country is not ours. We have been hosted. If somebody hosts you in his house and tells you tomorrow, I need you to go back, you don't have any choice.
In 2015, an attack by the Somalia-based Al-Shabaab militants changed Kenya forever. The Islamist group entered Garissa University and killed 148 people, mainly students in the university. In the aftermath of the attack, officials claimed that the Dadaab is where Al-Shabaab had planned its acts of terror, and as such there were calls for it to be shut down. Both Kenya's former and current presidents have repeatedly called for the closure of the camp and have asked the UNHCR to provide a roadmap to repatriate the refugees.
The events that led to the establishment of the Dadaab are terribly tragic, and the best response to that tragedy is to help the refugees to return and rebuild their nation.
We are not saying anything new. All we are saying is that we need to reduce the time it is going to take so that we can have these people go home. They say east or west, including south and north, home is best.
But repatriating hundreds of thousands of people is no small feat, especially with donor funding reduced by 70% over the past decade. The UNHCR presented a few options to Kenya, including integrating some of the refugees into their country and voluntary returns for those willing to go home. However, for many like Mark, he feels that the issues they fled still await them at home.
In Kenya, at least as a refugee, I have a space which I call my safe net, where I can stay safely. Of course, I know that a lot of things here in the camp are not perfect. Life is not perfect, but living in an imperfect life, as long as you are alive, is better than going to live in a perfect life and you die within a short time.
And for some of the newer generation, Dadaab is the only home they've ever known.
Because I was grown up here, I don't know anything. If you tell me today and ask me a question and say that, how is Somalia and how is it look like, or what information do you have in Somalia? I can say I have nothing. I cannot share with you anything. But if you ask me Kenya, I can share with you at least what's going on in the refugee camps. But Somalia, I don't have any hint. So I prefer Kenya home better than Somalia.
Thanks for listening to this episode. Next week on The Comb.
When we came to this country, though, people would whisper to you, you cannot beat your child here. And always say, you cannot beat your child. How else are you going to train them? Because you don't know any other way. So, you cannot beat. How can you be a parent and your hands are tight?
This episode was produced by Aisha Afra, Mary Goodhart, and me, Kim Chakanetsa. Rob Wilson did the sound design. Piers Lynch is our editor. Our studio manager was Stuart Holling-Drake.